Hello and welcome back to This Complex Life. Today I have another listener favourite from a couple of years ago, and this has been one of the all-time popular episodes on This Complex Life. And I had another listen to it, and it's still, there's some things that I still think are pretty accurate, and I might get Belinda back in for another conversation, but let's just see how things go. In this episode, we talk about that feeling of inadequacy, you know, just feeling like you're just not good enough. And I hear this all the time in my work, people saying, I'm just not good enough, or I don't feel good enough. They don't necessarily know why. It can come from a multitude of places, but it's a common expression. And inadequacy is a feeling that can feel really vulnerable, and we can mask with things like anger or frustration or even sadness. So in this episode, I chat with a good friend of mine, psychologist Belinda Gibson, about perfectionism, pressure, and that constant sense of just never quite measuring up. We recorded this as more of a conversation than a formal interview, and it's the two of us talking about some of the things that come up for us that we see in our work with clients. You know, we unpack some of these feelings, where they might come from, how they start, how they can show up in really sneaky ways, like trying to throw the perfect birthday party, and how they can impact relationships even without us realizing it. We talk about what helps, from being more curious to being a little less critical and having some self-compassion, to finding the right people to talk to when things feel hard. If this topic hits a nerve, you're definitely not alone. I hope this episode gives you something to think about and maybe even a sense of relief that you're not alone and a lot of people feel this way. Do you ever feel like you're just not good enough? That you're expected to be perfect all the time? In this chat with psychologist Belinda Gibson, a dear friend of mine and a podcast regular, there'll be a few episodes coming up with her and I having these conversations, we talk about this idea of not feeling good enough, about striving for perfection, and how that can lead to feeling dissatisfied in some of our relationships and can impact us in ways that we might not have even realized. We share some things that we've learned through the client work that we do, some of our own reflections, and discuss ways that you can start to be curious about how this might show up for you and how to choose the right people to have these conversations with to explore these things about yourself. Hope you enjoy my conversation with Belinda. Today we're talking about this idea of not feeling good enough. And more of a discussion than an interview, so something different to what we've done in the past. But what are your thoughts on that? Like, where do we even start to unpack the feelings that sometimes we have of not being good enough?
Where do we start? Well, where do the feelings first come from is what comes to my mind. You know, when did I start feeling not good enough? Because babies don't come into this world not feeling good enough. A baby feels good enough. So at some point we learn we're not good enough.
Yeah.
And then it becomes this feeling so strong that it feels like a knowing.
How does it show, like, how do we see it? Like, what do you notice in either clients you work with or in friends? Like, what kinds of things do people say that maybe indicate that they've got this belief? So like, I fucked it up again. I didn't get this right. What would you notice?
I think it's different, isn't it? I think some people use it as a way. I'm just trying to think, you know, someone is coming to mind now where they use this feeling of not being good enough. They almost lead with it. They present the vulnerability of not feeling good enough. And I think what they would often elicit from the other person then is this caretaking. Like, oh, no, you are. That then they elicit a lot of reassurance. Yeah. And then, you know, so in some ways they're really obvious with it. They vocalize it, they express it. I think for other people it's something they really hide away. They really struggle with it on their own. And I think when it's like that, it's much more subtle.
It makes me think of the different ways in which we look at schemas. Mm-hmm. And in schema therapy we have a couple of different things of thinking. You can overcompensate, which might be those mm-hmm. people like, I'm going to be super, super perfect mm-hmm. so no one can see that I feel like a fraud. Mm-hmm. And then you have that surrendering too, where it's just like, I'm going to lay it out there
yep.
because it's just so obvious
to me, and flip between those. Some people flip between them and some really stick in one of those positions.
Yeah.
Instead of that healthy middle that we want of, you know, the adult driving the brain. You know, think of Inside Out, the movie, you know, you want the adult person kind of running the show.
You know, I think it's interesting too, because how does it show up? I think in a therapeutic setting, it's much more obvious because as the client sits with you, you're hearing much more about their inner world. You're watching it, you're seeing it, you're feeling it, you're hearing it. I think it's much harder outside of that space because I think it might be expressed in things like with shoulds. I should have known, or I should have done that, or, you know, because the should kind of indicates this idea that I failed somehow, like I've not been good enough, that I've missed something, I haven't predicted something correctly. So I think when people kind of apologetically use the shoulds, it's often a way we can notice that maybe in that moment they're feeling some internal criticism or judgment or feeling I've not done it right, I'm not good enough in this setting.
I see it, and as you're talking, it gives me ideas of ways that I might have seen it in people. I think of like a hosting a dinner party or a birthday party or something and someone wanting it to be perfect and the cake has to be just so and the potatoes have to be cooked this way and the meat and the table and the napkins and that preoccupation with being maybe perfect and having everything kind of looking a certain way. But ironically, I remember hearing this saying of people want you to show up not to be perfect. They want consistency over perfection. And that sometimes we can be so preoccupied with trying to prove that we're not inadequate. Or I feel like sometimes that behavior gets you further from what you want.
I think most of our behaviors do that though, right? When I'm getting really grumpy at my partner for not knowing that I needed that thing, which the thing might be actually I needed closeness, it's probably not going to bring him closer to me, right? If I'm grumpy, he's going to be like, well, fine, I'll move away from you.
Yeah.
But my grumpiness is because I've not felt the closeness, right? So we're in this cycle together. But I think there is something about perfectionism and this idea in that example you gave. I think there is something about, because if the potatoes are perfect, if this dinner is perfect, then I'm good enough. Then I'm maybe I'm lovable.
Yeah.
You won't leave me, you won't hurt me.
Yeah.
So I come back to, where does it begin?
So if someone's listening and they're like, the penny's dropping, or there's like alarm bells going, or they're thinking, ah, okay, I can relate to some of this. What else could they start looking for? Like, what are they even, where do we even start to think, oh, I had no idea that I am running around like a headless chook trying to get this birthday party perfect because I want to give something to my kids that I never had, or I want to make up for something out. Like, how can they even, what's the first level of awareness?
I think people know when they feel not good enough. Mm-hmm. I think what they don't always know is all the ways in which that shows up and how it shapes their behavior. So, you know, that person throwing that dinner party, I think, has a sense of I'm not good enough. Like, even if it's this internal niggling feeling like I just never get it quite right, or I'm always just falling short, or I don't feel as good as X, Y, and Z, you know, I think they know that part.
Mm.
What often I think in therapy is we find out all of the ways that shows up and how it impacts how we are in our relationships, all of the ways in which it impacts how we feel, not just about ourselves, but generally our mood. You know, it will even in some ways impact the choices I make.
Yeah.
If I don't feel good enough, maybe I'm not making good choices for myself because I don't deserve those things. If I don't feel good enough, well, then I'm not going to try to level up or try this new thing because I'm going to fail anyway, and then that will be humiliating and it's just going to prove to me that I'm not good enough. So I think that it's something like, I know when I am having a day, a week, a moment of not feeling good enough. What I'm not always aware of is how that is influencing me in my relationships and choices and behavior. But I think people have the sense. I think that not good enough, it's such a what's the word, insidious.
It really is, yeah.
Feeling. I think people know it, but I think it's about the awareness attached to it is not always there.
Is it? Do you think it's contagious? Like, because I know anxiety can feel quite contagious. Like when someone around you is really anxious, their energy changes and their behavior, or someone's flustered or running late, there can be like a little tornado and that can really suck you in. Does this feel contagious? I'm picturing, let's say, baking a cake. And if you've got, if that's how this shows up and this has to be perfect, you might prefer to just go buy one and make it, like, just have a perfect cake.
Yep.
I don't know, whatever's in fashion now, like a nude cake with beautiful adornments and stuff on top. Or you could try that Old Woman's Weekly Cookbook and make one from scratch and it be kind of, maybe the icing doesn't come out right.
Yeah.
But that bit of you that wants it to be perfect, what does that then show to other people? I can picture someone seeing that as criticism of them, of like, oh, if you've got this high standard of when I come to your house, this cake has to be perfect, and you've harped on about it for months and months and months, and the cake wasn't perfect and the potatoes weren't perfect. Are you judging me when you come to my house for dinner? Am I not good enough for you?
Not good enough meets my not good enough.
Yeah, right? Does it start to kind of keep perpetuating itself in those friendships?
Well, I think if you're not good enough meets my not good enough, but if I'm entering that relationship with you where I don't give a flying fuck about the potatoes, I'm just excited to be here. Your potatoes could be really crap.
That actually sounds like a conversation we've had before where I said, this isn't the best, and you're like, this is delicious. Yeah. Thank you.
But because that doesn't meet my not good enough.
What right? do you mean by that?
Like, I mean that my not good enough doesn't manifest in that space.
Okay, in cooking.
Right? Yeah. It just doesn't. I know I can't cook. I can't cook. I'm bad at it. Love to eat. Love to eat your food. But I can't cook. So it doesn't meet my not good enough. It meets a clear knowing for me, but it's also not something I value within myself. It's not something that I struggle with. Yeah. I just know that that's true and I'm okay with that.
But could it for someone, like if a friendship?
It could if that was something where I felt really not good enough, like that somehow I'm failing as a person because I can't cook or I don't enjoy that. And I imagine that when you talked about contagion, the thing that kind of came to me is where I think it's contagious in a significant way is in the parenting of our children.
Mm-hmm.
See, I like food. Thankfully, my partner is a very good cook, so we enjoy good food in our home because he provides that for us.
We'll make sure he listens to this bit.
I will. But there is something about, for my daughter, she hasn't attached to cooking as a joyful experience. She likes to eat it. Now, because it's not something that I struggle with in, if you don't like cooking, that means you're not good enough.
Yeah.
Then she doesn't
care.
It doesn't even know that that's a possibility.
Yeah.
But if I'm within myself going, oh, I'm failing, particularly as a woman being socialized to.
If you vocalized it.
Well, I think even on an unconscious level.
Yeah.
If I'm always apologizing, if I'm feeling flustered in the kitchen, if I'm huffing and puffing, if I look stressed.
Yeah.
Then she starts to get this association, this like, oh, am I meant to be good at that? Oh, God, oh, well, I'm not good at that, or I don't care about that, or I'm not interested. Oh, I think something's wrong. So I think it's when our not good enoughs meet.
Right.
So
it's the messages we get.
I think hugely.
So that would be, I mean, if we think back to what you said about we're not born that way, this is where it could come from, right? Is it might subconsciously have been absorbed from your surroundings of the comments people make.
Sometimes it's even more subtle than that. I remember reading somewhere, I can't cite it, I apologize, but I remember reading a woman's experience of raising a daughter in terms of body image. And what she was speaking about is what she'd never noticed is that the last thing she would do before leaving the bathroom is she would turn around, look at her back, and she would go, and then walk out. So she's giving herself a judgment, a criticism. I don't look the way I want to. Something isn't right here.
Yeah.
And what she noticed is when her daughter reached adolescence, her daughter started turning around, looking, going, ugh, and leaving the bathroom. It was only seeing her daughter mirroring her own behavior that she's noticing, ah, I am passing on my not good enough. I am giving her clear messages that something about her, in this sense, her physical form, that's not good enough. I think that a baby is born feeling pretty good enough.
Yeah.
Generally speaking,
well,
because
even
some
little
babies'
kids, body
trauma.
Image is a really important one. Of, yeah. You know, you see little kids run around naked, or you know, playing with the hose in summer, and they don't care.
They're not looking at their body as an observer. That little piece of writing, what really stood out for me is that the daughter learned to look at herself as an observer, not to feel her body, not to enjoy her body, not to use her body, but to see her body, and to see her body is not good enough. So I think it's when our not good enoughs meet.
Yeah, that's so tricky, because this is where, like, if people are resonating with this, it might be really, it takes a lot of effort to go back and through that, you know, your memory bank, think, where did I get this message? Where did I get the message I'm not something enough, good enough, smart enough, creative enough? Because those beliefs, they show up everywhere. You know, finances, I'm not good at managing money.
Yep.
I'm not creative. And then, and it's one bit of that makes me sad, because it implies we have to be good at something to just enjoy it.
Yes.
Like painting, coloring and drawing. Yes. It's like, you don't have to be an artist. You can just enjoy it.
Yep.
But that has been shut down for a lot of people. Like, I'm not artistic.
Yes, therefore I shouldn't do it.
So does that mean you can't enjoy playing, or I kill everything in the garden? Like, do you still find it fun to try? Like, do you find it also disempowers some people? Like, if you've got that belief, then it takes away responsibility of, but I can learn. I can learn to paint if I want to get better at it. I can learn to, I'm never going to be, you know, at my height, I'm never going to be a great basketballer if I just pick it up now, never having played. But I can learn it.
Yeah.
It's a skill I can acquire. Like, how does it kind of fuck us up?
Well, I think this is interesting too, because now I think we're kind of talking about when the not good enough is a skill-based not good enough.
Right.
I think that, you know, going back to that mother and daughter, there's something different there, because it's about I, as this human being in this body, I am not good enough.
Yeah.
This is more shame-based, I think. And I think that is different to a skill practical way. So, and maybe that's the cooking example too. Maybe that's because I'm like, look, if I really wanted to, I could learn it. I just don't have that interest. But if I'm feeling not good enough in a more intrinsic way, as more connected to who I am, that is more shame provoking. And that, I think, is a different thing. I'm not good enough as a friend.
It feels like they're buddied though, right? Because if you, I suspect, and some of the people I've worked with when we touch on this, if you do feel shameful, it's really hard to have a growth mindset. Like, if you feel fundamentally, I'm not enough, I'm not enough as a human.
Yeah.
It disempowers you to think, to, you know, to calm your nervous system and be like, okay, what's really going on?
Yeah.
I can learn this, or I can do this. Like, it's really hard to grow, to try new things, to be vulnerable, to wade through the discomfort, to try a new recipe, to give something a go, if the fear of failure that's then linked to shame. And like, it feels like they're so intrinsically linked.
I agree. I think that it would be hard to know where one starts and one begins. Sorry, one begins and one ends, right?
Like, they go round and round.
Yeah, and they are in relationship with each other, and they absolutely influence each other. I think that there is something much more immobilizing when it's fear, shame-based, when it's that fear of I will be seen for my not good enough. And then what happens?
Yeah.
And I think this is about what we learn in our families, which is, if I'm not good enough, what do you do? Do you abandon me in some way? Do you reject me in some way? Because that is, at the core, annihilating to me. Mm-hmm. I can't live as a child if you abandon and reject me.
Yeah.
It takes away something core to my survival. So this then becomes something so entrenched and embedded at me that I cannot not be good enough, because it will be annihilating. And I think often when people come into therapy, part of what I often do and try to work with them on is, when did this start? And what's different now? Yeah. Because as a child, we're limited. We don't have much choice or control. And we always internalize it, that it's us, because we can't see our caregivers as not being good, right?
Yeah.
Right? It's part of our survival.
It would rather be the bad kid rather than have the bad family. We're not good enough rather than they can't meet our needs. It's developmentally, that's just where we
absolutely
sit.
And it's part of our survival. Now, if I don't go into that place, if I don't, and typically you do this in therapy, because where else do you have a friend sit down and, you know, say, take me back, like, what happened? You know, then I still live in this space of, if I fail, if I'm not good enough for you, then I'll be annihilated. And the reality is, as adults, that often won't be the case. But we have to heal, we have to go back, we have to understand and learn and build our awareness around, what is this? Why do I feel not good enough?
It, as you were talking, an example came to mind of, I wonder if it holds people back having tough conversations, because it's like, if I have a rupture in this friendship, or if I give feedback, or if I hold a boundary.
Yeah.
And you don't like it,
yeah,
the cutoff will be like, the consequence feels huge.
Massive.
So we kind of try and maintain this in whatever way comes out for you, whether it is the perfect party or over pleasing or something else.
Yeah.
It shows up in not being boundaried, in being a people pleaser and a perfect. It shows up in so many ways, because the idea of disappointing you or letting you down, that relationship won't recover. I wonder if at the same time it keeps a relationship at an arm's length. Yeah. Like, it kind of, it's not entirely integrated or intimate or authentic, because I don't know, there's too much pressure there maybe.
Well, there's maybe too much risk. And it's too much risk.
Because if you're not holding boundaries, if you're not being authentic, if you're not saying, hey, what you said hurt me.
Yeah.
Because you're coming from, I'm not good enough, so I don't deserve this. The relationship's not built on trust, in a way that there's an element of trust missing.
Mm-hmm. I wonder in some ways what you're talking about is, I avoid conflict out of fear that if conflict emerges, that I will experience that rejection or abandonment, that you will leave, again, that this will somehow reveal my not good enough, that I might have got it wrong or I've hurt you and all of these things, then activate that childhood experience where this is dangerous now, the risk is too great, so I withhold whatever I'm thinking, feeling, if there is difference with you. I think that that happens a lot, and I think that there is such, I did a training on Friday, there were 30 people there, and I would say 27 out of that 30, as they went around and checked out at the end of the day, sort of said their whole what am I left with kind of comment or statement. All of those 27 out of 30 spoke around their feeling of connection during the day and the absence of that normally for them. I think that often when I'm meeting and sitting with people, I say often, but it does feel like almost everyone talks about this feeling and need and absence of true connection. And I think what you're talking about is one of the reasons we don't often feel satisfied with our connection, because we enter them with a lot of fear and we protect ourselves. And in that protection, we're not really showing up. We're not really connecting. And often you and I have had many conversations where there's been a lot of difference. But they're often the times where my trust in you has grown.
Always.
Because I'm like, oh, we can do this together.
Yeah.
We can do the hard conversations and you'll stick in there with me. You know, my personal fear from my childhood and family is that if I say something that you don't like, then you will reject me, you will leave. And the way that that often showed up was with the withholding of love.
Yeah.
That I'm not going to talk to you, I'm not going to look at you, go away.
Yeah.
Right. So now I have to really hold myself when I have those hard conversations, trust and support myself that I will be okay, and trust that that person can do this with me.
It's really the elements of trust that Brené Brown articulates. And one of them is integrity, saying what you mean, meaning what you say, and choosing courage over comfort.
Yeah. But it is courage.
It is, which is ironic because busting your ass to have the perfect party is actually really hard work.
Yeah.
And that people seem to prefer to do that than sit with the vulnerability of having the conversation of saying, hey, I'm exhausted. I can't do this. Or my preference would be that we get takeout or I want to show you this amazing party, but this is our budget. Like, it's part of why I wanted to have these kinds of conversations in this way is I think we oversimplify them and we don't spend time to unpack what's going on, what conversation do I need to have, and be prepared that when you change, that might not suit some people and that's okay. If that wasn't authentic to
feel okay.
Then it was maybe not a relationship you needed. If they're going to crack the shits because you've decided to no longer have the perfect party.
Yeah.
Then there may be friends that you don't need in that season of your life anymore. That you've outgrown.
Totally understand what you're saying and appreciate it and agree.
Intellectually.
Yeah. And an intellectual level, I'm saying yes. I'm screaming yes and yes. But.
And
is a better word. And that experience, if we're not careful, so say we kind of enter that space authentically, that person leaves in some way, then if we're not careful, that reinforces the childhood experience of me not being good enough again and becomes evidence. See?
Yeah.
Freaking told you. I'm not good enough. Why would I do that?
Yeah.
And then the critic and the judgment and the internal punishment goes on a rampage if we're not careful.
Yeah.
Because the way you're saying it and framing it, I think can be protective. But if we don't have that language, if we don't have that mindset, then I think there's that risk.
So how can people take what's the first step they can take? So, you know, these are just tips and it's just, you know, our kind of thoughts out loud. But if people wanted to try something different, you know, obviously being therapist, I wish everyone would do therapy.
Yep,
I think it's amazing.
Welcome.
And we appreciate that that's, you know, at times it's hard to find the right person and it's not an expense that everyone can afford. Yeah. But where can people start? Like, I know self-compassion is a huge one and I'll put in a link in the show notes. Kristen Neff has some really great self-compassion resources and really beautiful. Have you done her meditation?
No.
So really beautiful guided meditation and she's got a self-compassion checklist.
Nice.
So you can actually see how self-compassionate you are.
Yeah.
But what other, where else can people start? Like what are tools that you?
Look, I do really want to reiterate I think therapy and how this can really assist in better understanding ourselves. And there certainly are low cost, long term psychotherapy clinics out there if you can find them. But I think, you know, reading the Brené Brown's.
Her book, like The Gifts of Imperfections.
Gifts of Imperfection.
Starting with that.
Yep.
She's got a Netflix documentary as well.
She does, if you're more into the watching. She's got loads of YouTube little clips even. But I think absolutely reading, watching, and where you can really sort of start the practice of reflecting and being curious, not critical.
Yeah.
If my clients, anyone that's ever sat with me will have heard a million times.
Curious, not critical.
Be curious, not critical.
Yeah, don't be like, this is just another thing I'm not good at. Right. I can't self-reflect.
Yeah. But just curiously, what is happening for me here?
Yeah.
Am I trying to please this person or actually do I want to do this thing?
Yeah.
Do I really care about the potatoes or is this a way I'm trying to make myself look good enough?
Mm.
Really get curious about yourself and if you can, find your people.
Find your
people that can let you be you.
I use the analogy and if you've seen Inside Out, it sort of makes sense of that. But this idea of, think of a bus and there are different, like there's passengers on the bus, but they're all different parts of you.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be a part of you that's like maybe sitting at the back bored. There'll be a part of you that's like, are we there yet? What's going on? There'll be a part of you snoozing. Like we all have different parts.
Absolutely.
And actually thinking, who's driving the bus?
Yeah.
Is this my calm, cool, collected, kind of healthy adult self that's taken charge and realized, oh, this feeling's uncomfortable,
yeah,
but it's actually not in response to this? It's something from the past. Or is the 9-year-old you driving? Or is it the scare? Like, maybe starting to think about who's in the driver's seat?
And are those parts talking, or are they screaming at each other?
They just fight for dominance. But actually, when I go in there and I actually get curious about where did these parts come from, what's the purpose, how do they serve me, then actually they often can work together. And sometimes one needs to soothe the other, right? Often for me, my fear can lead. And that's usually a smaller part of me. So the adult part can come in and be like, actually, I can do this for you. Sit back down, right?
So if someone's listening to this and they are like, oh, okay, something's resonated with me, I want to share this with a parent, a partner, a friend, without it setting it up to fail by just sort of saying, I don't know, sharing this, saying in a text message, being like, listen to this, let's talk. Like, how can people introduce this topic to someone?
The first thing, though, I have this caution, is choose your people.
Right.
Choose the people that are safe. Right. Choose the people that can do that with you, that have shown in some way that they can be with you when it's hard or uncomfortable. Choose your people.
Yeah.
Look for people that are safe, because especially if you're just starting out in having these conversations, and check with their willingness to do that. Ask them, is this a conversation that you're up for?
So I would, I've scripted this sort of stuff with clients in the past where we've actually helped write a draft text message of saying, or, just saying, hey, I've been working on understanding myself better, or I've been going to therapy, whatever the situation is, and there are a couple of resources I found insightful. Would you be open to listening to this with me, or in your own time, so we can then have a chat, or I can tell you what bits resonated for me, or this podcast or this blog post articulated something in a way I couldn't.
Yeah,
would you be open to helping me understand it more? Like, how else can people start to do that? Because I find when I break it down like that, it's helpful for people. They don't know how to introduce it. They'll just send it to a partner or a friend and be like, this is me. And then that person can feel not good enough, or criticized, or caught off guard, or what are you trying to say?
Well, that person has their own experience, totally. Right? So that person, often, you might be meeting, they're not good enough. Yeah, and then they're like, well,
how have I let you down again? Like, if you sent this to a, your mum, for example, they might be like, well, so everything comes down to mum. I did the best I could. And they might trigger a defensiveness instead of it being like, hey, I'm not blaming you, but this really spoke to me, which I hope it did.
Yeah.
We love to hear that. Can we talk about it? Or can you have a listen? And if you feel okay, let's have a chat. And we talk, I say it, talk about the talking, like discuss how you're going to discuss it.
Yeah. I also think about owning your part. Because I think it depends on how you use your language as to how someone might respond, right? So owning your experience and really expressing what your need is. So first kind of checking in, what do I need in this conversation? What do I need to get out of this? What is it that I want?
Okay.
And how can that person support and provide that? Because sometimes if someone was kind of coming at me with something and I don't feel like I have any idea what you want from me, one, I might then offer something that isn't, so you feel let down again or misunderstood, right? So then I might be inadvertently replaying.
Like if they want to vent, but you're trying to problem solve, or they want to explore and you're trying to just apologize, whatever.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So even just being clear on what is it that I need or want in this interaction, so I can ask for it. You know, sometimes with my partner, when I'm feeling whatever, upset, he loves to offer a solution.
That's so annoying.
But I'm an intelligent woman. I already thought of that. That's not what I need.
Yeah.
So now what I do is I go in really explicitly. I want to tell you what happened today. I don't want you to offer a solution, but after I finish talking, can you please hug me tight?
Yeah.
He can do that. He feels equipped then. He doesn't feel like I'm setting him up. He doesn't feel like I'm going to just discharge whatever, my anger on him. He's like, yes, enthusiastically, yes, let's do that, because it's clear. And I know then what I need and I can get it.
So we're sort of saying in sum to think about who we choose to have this conversation with, mm-hmm. then talk, have a think about how you want to have the conversation,
mm-hmm.
and starting to have some clarity around what you hope to get from it and letting them know that. So yeah. Do you want insight? Do you want a dialogue? Is it just, hey, I listened to this episode and I had all these thoughts. I want to share them with you, or I want to hear what, if you've had these same thoughts.
Yeah. And maybe you don't know what you want. Yeah. So even just saying that, that actually, and all I know is I want to talk to you about this.
Yeah.
I don't know what I need from it.
Awesome. It's good stuff. And if people want to unpack this more, find a good therapist.
Yeah, I think so.
And I think they're conversations where there's still a lot of destigmatized we want to do about mental health, but this isn't, like, not all therapies are around recovering from mental illness.
Mm.
These are the kinds of things that are, it can be roadblocks or mind blocks in our lives, or, you know, get us stuck in different sort of patterns. So therapy can be really helpful to unpack all of these things. It's not necessarily just for mental illness.
I would say 99.9% of my clients come because they want to understand who they are on a deeper level, yeah. and how they enter the world, how they enter relationships, and how they get or interrupt themselves getting what they need.
Same. I think it starts off sometimes with symptoms that feel pressing.
Yep.
Like I'm feeling too anxious or overwhelmed.
Yep.
And then once we get through a few of those sessions through,
yep.
then it's, there's all these underlying things.
Yeah, like I'm feeling anxious because I feel like I can't cope with what's going to come.
Right.
Right. And so I'm spending all this energy trying to predict and control my environment, and I'm exhausted and I'm constantly scared.
So hopefully that gives people somewhere to get started.
I hope so.